This is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman. The World Health Organization wants money, a lot of money, to carry it through, to carry a new plan through against the China virus. This is Thursday, February 6th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. You are part of this program. Make sure you join us on VOA Asia Facebook. Also ahead, the Wuhan virus is spreading very quickly. We will explore what the virus outbreak is doing to worldwide shipping, and the U.S. Senate is having its say on the impeachment of Donald Trump. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Some 3,700 people are facing at least 2 weeks locked away on a cruise liner anchored off Japan after health officials confirmed on Wednesday that 10 people on that ship had tested positive for the coronavirus and more cases were possible. It follows a steep rise in deaths in China and airlines suspending flights to Hong Kong, with the virus affecting people in more than 20 countries. We are working on some technical difficulties. We'll see if Reuters' Michelle Hennessy is available. Guess not. Well, speaking Wednesday at the World Health Organization headquarters, WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said the majority of the cases still remain in China. The doctor said that all cases outside of China had some connection to Hubei province, the epicenter of it all. Taking a look at the origins of the coronavirus, many health experts believe the novel coronavirus that originated in China initially passed to humans from a wild animal, probably a bat. That's why some disease experts are looking at the wet markets in Africa and in Asia where live animals, including wild animals, are sold and butchered. These are among the top Asia headlines you'll find right now at voanews.com. Investigators from the International Criminal Court are in the process of gathering evidence for a case involving alleged crimes against humanity by Myanmar met against Rohingya Muslims. Rosma Mansour, the wife of Malaysian ex-premier Najib Razak, has gone on trial for corruption. Her trial focuses on allegations that she received bribes connected to a government project. India wants to double defense exports over the next 5 years as the country seeks to cut its import bill. The death toll from the coronavirus outbreak in China passed 490 on Wednesday as two U.S. airlines suspended flights to Hong Kong. Make sure you read and watch more on VOA Asia Facebook and Twitter, plus the voanews.com website. With many Chinese cities on a virtual lockdown and businesses closed until next week at the earliest, there are growing concerns about coronavirus's impact on the global economy. On Tuesday, automaker Hyundai Motors said it would suspend production in South Korea, its biggest manufacturing base, becoming the first major automaker to do so outside China due to disruption in the supply of parts resulting from the coronavirus outbreak. With much of China shutting down, we were wondering how this has affected trade between China and the rest of the world, particularly trade between China and the United States. To find out, I contacted Phil Levy, a man well-informed about this, with a background as a high-level economist and now the senior economist at the shipping company Flexport. He said so far, water transportation has not been overly affected. However, airlines have, with so many... Okay, I believe we now have Phil Levy. You are a former federal government economist working under George W. Bush. Now you are in the freight business. And how is the freight business being affected by the coronavirus?
Biggest thing we can point to right now is you've seen lots and lots of flight cancellations. These are generally passenger aircraft flying in and out of China. What many people don't realize, those passenger aircraft also have belly cargo, as they describe it, which is that it's not just your suitcases down there. There's also pallets of goods being shipped back and forth. And that is a fair bit of air capacity that has been taken offline, in many cases through March, April, in one case even through May.
So what happens to ships going back and forth? Have they been canceled at all? Have they been detoured in any way?
So far, we're not getting reports of ships being canceled. However, it's important to remember that that's one component in a supply chain. So what we have not seen really come back as expected is trucking, which means if ships are dropping containers at ports, for example, those they need to have sort of new containers brought for loading or old containers cleared from the ports. In China, we're not seeing that as much. The thing to remember, and the reason it's a little bit tricky to give a full assessment, is every year, thankfully most of them without a major viral outbreak, every year you have the whole country of China mostly shut down for Chinese New Year. And this happened just around that time. So we were seeing almost no economic activity in China last week, but that was what everybody expected to see. It's this week and into next when you're starting to notice the difference, when the factories were supposed to come back online, the air freight was supposed to pick up perhaps by this coming weekend, and the question then is what will happen with that resumption? Will it take place as usual? And I think the answer is very likely to be no.
Well, one would think that was the case, and that leads to my next question. We have many people listening to this right now who are living in China. They are blocked at almost every move they make. Why isn't shipping affected?
So it certainly will be for the other links in the chain. If you're talking about ocean freight, which is the bulk of the way goods move around the world, ocean freight, you can have crews in shipping vessels who have relatively little interactions with ports, and you have a lot of the stuff automated where you can have cranes taking containers on and off of ships. And so that part can proceed. I hope I didn't say that this is unaffected, because we have seen some reductions in sailings. We've seen lower capacity usage on some of the ships, but it has not been as dramatic as it has been with air. It will very much be affected if the factories don't reopen on schedule and if you don't have, for example, truckers moving goods around internally in China.
What is the overall feeling of the shipping industry about this?
Apprehension. There's a lot of uncertainty about how this is going to play out. We just did a survey of our customers and asked the question, when do you think that factories are going to reopen? The norm probably would have been this week. You had, I think, roughly a third of the respondents say next week, a third said the week after, and about a third said later than that. Now, there can be legitimately different answers for different people. They may know very well what's happening, but there's just a lot of uncertainty about what's going on.
How much of the reduction in freight and freight traffic is due to not so much the coronavirus, but to U.S.-China trade?
Well, you're right. This is actually coming at a time when you were already going to have a couple serious challenges to the logistics and the freight business. One, as you mentioned, you had a trade war that was going on, and that trade war, although there was an agreement in January, that didn't end the trade war. That actually left us with a lot of tariffs in place. So we already had reduced volumes because of that. So this is coming at an awkward time, and it's a little bit difficult to disentangle some of those things. There's sort of several categories into which you could sort of place concern. One category is, will production resume? Another category is, will we be able to have the supply chain and the transportation links move the way they're supposed to? And then a third category is, what's going to happen to overall demand? Will this push towards a recession or something of that sort?
The United States Senate held a vote today, a very important vote, whether or not the country's president, Donald Trump, will be thrown out of office on impeachment charges. VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has been following this all the way. And Catherine, what happened?
Well, President Trump was found not guilty on both charges or the articles of impeachment that had passed through the Democratic majority U.S. House of Representatives. Both of those articles of impeachment failed in the Republican majority U.S. Senate, with the exception of one Republican senator, Mitt Romney of Utah, who did vote against the president of his own party, who said that he was guilty of abuse of power.
This was expected, was it not?
This is the outcome that was very much expected from the beginning, really, even before the Democratic House voted to pass those articles of impeachment. It was known that it would be extremely difficult to get these articles of impeachment past the Republican majority in the U.S. Senate. That's indeed what ended up happening. But as many of the House impeachment managers have been saying today to reporters, including me, they are going to continue with investigations into President Trump, likely leading up to a court order compelling former National Security Advisor John Bolton to testify.
Well, they can't impeach again, can they? Or can they?
There's nothing to say that they cannot impeach the president again, but remember that we are in a presidential election year when Democrats do not want to step over themselves. They don't want to tire voters out with the back-and-forth partisan bickering on Capitol Hill. They want to move ahead. They need to move ahead from a Iowa caucus that really no clear winner emerged from in the Democratic Party. They need to solidify their voters. They need to move on to November so that they can beat Donald Trump in a reelection campaign. Not entirely sure how much continuing investigations would really help their case on that front.
Catherine Gibson is VOA's congressional correspondent and has done yeoman work throughout all of these investigations. Thank you, Catherine. Get some rest after this.
Thank you so much.
She has been working so hard.
She has been.
So many weeks.
She has been probably the most in-demand correspondent that we have for the last several weeks. And just imagine the scope of what we've seen. We've seen...
By the way, Doug Bernard is the person who is talking.
Okay. sitting here with Ira Melman. You know, I mean, think about the scope of what we've seen. Just in the last several days, the impeachment of the president, the trial of the president, and the Iowa caucuses, which is really kind of when the entire 2020 election, you know, actually gets rolling, when people start actually committing their names to a candidate or a piece of paper or what have you. So it's really been remarkable. She's done terrific work. I think in some ways that the impeachment may have overshadowed, I may be wrong on this, but may have overshadowed the Iowa caucuses. You know, here you had...
Democrats are happy about that after what happened.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, I imagine many of them are, frankly. You know, the House Speaker Nancy Pelosi famously was kind of dragged into this entire impeachment process. She'd said for months that she didn't think this was the way to go. And yet in the end, you know, in her judgment, it was the thing that the House simply had to do.
So as far as that decision is concerned, there were those who were arguing, including Nancy Pelosi, that bringing up impeachment proceedings would further divide the country even more than it was.
Mm.
You think it is?
I think the country is clearly divided. And, you know, you don't have to, you know, be a magician to look at the poll numbers. And just this week, the approval rating for President Trump has risen to 49%. That's probably one of the highest approval ratings he's got so far.
Still lower than most presidents.
Still lower than most presidents, and still below that important 50% or 51% margin. But, you know, there's 49% of the population who think, hey, he's doing a good job. I like what he's about. I like the cut of his jib. And, you know, the Democrats in Washington should really just leave him alone and let him be. Meanwhile, on the other hand, you have many Democrats who are saying, you know, no, in fact, you should go after President Trump more forcefully than you have in the past. So, you know, it's there's a very stark division, I think.
Well, many of the Democrats and many of the so-called pundits, and we are not those, by the way.
No.
Yeah, but many of the so-called pundits, pundits are saying that, this further establishes what Trump apparently is doing, which is almost establishing a kingdom.
Well, you know, the White House, from the beginning of this process, had been saying, whether they meant it or not, we don't know, but they had been saying that they welcome impeachment because they think it would be to the benefit of President Trump in the end. We're going to have to wait and see, you know, how that plays out. I'm not sure. Well, I don't know. I mean, nobody could really say that they know. But, you know, the White House had been signaling that while there might be some private concern and worry about being impeached, that's something that will never, ever go away, that they were in some ways welcoming it.
Well, then we have the story of Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney, a Republican senator and a former unsuccessful presidential mm-hmm. candidate, was the only Republican to vote for the articles of impeachment. And he made an impassioned speech about it.
He did. You know, there had been a lot of talk that maybe other Republicans might join in the effort to bring, to call witnesses or to call for documents, that kind of thing. In the end, none of them actually materialized. And in the end, on this vote, Mitt Romney, he only voted for one of the articles of impeachment. He sided with the president. So the votes were 52-48 and then 53-47. So President Trump was able to really hold his entire Republican caucus in the Senate together. Some of the credit for that must go to the majority leader, Senator McConnell. But, you know, it seems clear that the president is fully in control of the Republican Party at this point, and that there really aren't any Republicans, Mitt Romney notwithstanding, willing to challenge him on that.
And people seem to be worried, as far as that is concerned, on the Democratic side, where they're asking themselves whether or not any or which of the candidates can beat Donald Trump in November. By the way, you're listening to VOA Asia, and I know we're not talking about Asia now, but we have a lot of expats in our audience, and we are hoping that you would like to listen to two non-experts and pundits talk about this. But nevertheless, I mean, where do we go from here?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Clearly, I think that this election, 2020, is going to have global impact. We've seen in his first term, President Trump has famously initiated a, we won't call it a trade war, but trade difficulties, what have you, with China and with other nations. He pulled out of the TPP. So Asia is clearly going to focus high on President Trump's, if he is reelected, on his schedule for the next 4 years. You mentioned the unity in the Republican Party. What we're seeing in the Democratic Party right now, I think, is disunity. There are many candidates. None of them really seems to be breaking out. None of them really seems to kind of have that, you know, that fire or that sense of inevitability.
But to be fair, we only have one caucus didn't work.
That's right. Yeah, we still don't even really know the results, the full results of that caucus, the Iowa caucus. We still don't know. And it was on Monday night, which is kind of crazy. And the
beware of new apps.
Yes.
Doug wants to explain that, I'll let him.
I think it's self-explanatory. So a number of the candidates, especially among them, former Mayor Pete Buttigieg, is, you know, their campaign is really kind of tied in a knot about this because they wanted to come out of Iowa, you know, waving the flag. We were victorious. We won. We came out on top. And as of yet, nobody's actually been able to say that. So everybody's sort of scrambling and kind of trying to grab for the title of who's the winner, who's going to be the comeback kid, all this kind of stuff. And so, you know, you are seeing a fair amount of disunity in the Democratic Party.
He's Doug Bernard. I'm Ira Melman. We have been discussing the historic vote in the U.S. Senate today, just exonerating Donald Trump of all impeachment charges. Let's check out politics, but in another country. How about India? 2 months after a controversial citizenship law passed by Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi's Bharatiya Janata Party government sparked a wave of protests by students and women, the Indian capital city will hold polls to elect a new local government on Saturday. That's February 8th. As the BJP tries to wrest the prestigious city government from a city-based party that rules Delhi, the election will indicate whether the party retains its popularity among young voters who have been its enthusiastic supporters. Our reporter, Anjana Pasricha, has details from New Delhi.
Some sing songs, others paint posters outside a university campus in New Delhi, as they slam a new citizenship law that fast-tracks nationality for non-Muslim immigrants as discriminatory against India's largest minority. The protests reflect the changed mood among many college students, 8 months after they helped Prime Minister Narendra Modi win a resounding victory in national elections. As is Bharatiya Janata Party campaigns for a local government in Delhi, some worry that the party's prime focus has moved from development to a Hindu nationalist agenda.
Even in Delhi, you're trying to gain, you know, Hindu voters by making comments like, you know, this is India versus Pakistan, this is not Delhi elections, this is India versus Pakistan, but we don't care if we won't get Muslim votes. So all this kind of, you know, upsets me.
There's no question about it. They are a divisive party.
After winning a second term, Modi scrapped the special status of Muslim-majority Kashmir, and the Supreme Court granted permission to build a Hindu temple on the site of a mosque. The BJP has refused to back down from the citizenship law.
For these policies, the support for BJP is very large, immense support. And as I said earlier also, if BJP starts showing the path that they are willing to negotiate, they are willing to, you know, take two steps backward, maybe these core supporters of BJP, core supporters of these policies, they would start getting disillusioned.
But many students have been alienated by the government's refusal to engage with them.
This attitude of dictatorial style of functioning, that yes, we have brought in this legislation, we are not going to budge on this. I think that attitude has angered youths.
The Aam Aadmi Party that rules Delhi has campaigned on its record of improving education and healthcare. The BJP is wooing voters on a plank of nationalism. That worries some young people, including its supporters.
I believe BJP is a good bet. I do. But more of the concentration has been going on the agenda, such as religious agendas.
The call among young people is to focus on rebooting a faltering economy.
We are students. We want employment. We want good education, good jobs, but no one talks about it.
How the BJP fares in the high-stakes Delhi battle will indicate whether the protests against the citizenship law by students and women have dented its popularity or helped consolidate its base among Hindu voters. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
And you have been listening to VOA Asia. Remember to get our program on iTunes and SoundCloud and at many other areas and platforms. Thanks to you for doing that, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Nelson Lopes, managing editor, Diane Gao, and our team of Jim Stevenson, Doug Bernard, and Keith Lane. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Have a wonderful day ahead.